This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 10th, 1997. I'm at Professor Vince Rideout's house. I'm here with Paul Morledge, and we're here to continue our interview that we began last week. We're going to start out talking today about your research. And at Bell Labs, you worked on a lot of problems with electronics and with communication. You were hired by the UW. We talked about your hiring last week. How did this work at Bell Lab, this work that you performed at Bell Lab, did that continue at UW, and in what form, and how did that eventually change over the years?
To some extent, I continued the work. The work involved radar and the high frequencies that we first began to use in radar. And so at Bell Labs, this was my concern, except towards the last of my 7-year stay there, when I began to work on television relaying. And upon coming to Wisconsin, I realized that they were at least 7 years behind the whole time of World War II. And so I did my best to work in the areas of microwave communication, not so much radar, because that's a wartime thing.
What about equipment and things like that? Did UW have adequate equipment or adequate funding? How did you handle that end of it?
Well, we had a little funding, and we got some pieces of waveguide and instruments that we needed. It was pretty bad, of course, but when you start from nothing, why, any old piece of equipment looked pretty good. And the students were interested. I had quite a bit of trouble getting the okay to teach anything but some deadly machines courses to mechanical engineers. But I persisted, mainly by starting new graduate courses and starting to work with graduate students. In these areas that involved the very high frequencies.
Now, when you started this work, you said you eventually got graduate students involved in it. Did you continue with your connections at Bell Lab? And or were there people here at UW, new people perhaps, who were interested in that area and who you could talk to about it?
Well, certainly there were people I could talk to, but they were mostly students, graduate students who'd been in some kind of radar work or something during the war. So there was John Asmuth and Bob Parent, and a few more.
As graduate students?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I guess I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. Well, I think that Parent did not go on for his PhD, but several other fellows did. At least one of them with me.
Was there a whole host of institutions that were working on radar this time, or I got the feeling
they didn't pay too much attention to radar because it's a wartime thing, and they needed communications, and they were more concerned with that, and rightly so.
And how much more did you do, and how far did you take the television stuff that you had started at Bell Lab? Did you work at that all? Television relays, was that worked at here as well?
No, that was kind of an engineering development. Some of the things I worked on, Jerry Estrin was a graduate student of mine, and we worked on microwaves using, as I recall, plastic foam of some sort with small pellets, metal pellets embedded in it, and used this as lens material. And so we did measurements involving this kind of...
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that was something new, but still I was using the methods, equipment, and the high frequencies that I'd become familiar with.
Now, in the book that we got from the Department of Electrical Engineering, called Electrical Engineering at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, A Centennial History, 1891 to 1991, which is on file at the UW Oral History Project for anybody listening to this tape, there's talk about you getting involved with the Filbert with computers around, what, about 1950 or so?
It was earlier than that, really.
Could you tell your how you first got into computers and how that started developing?
Well, you know, Harold Peterson came from General Electric at the same time I came from Bell Laboratories. And Harold had had some excellent experience there working with computers of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Big mechanical.
Huge.
Oh, yeah, they would occupy a space equal to the floor space of this house,
or
most of it, I think. Very noisy, big old machines. We had a chance to get one for free a few years later, and we refused to take it. That was a wise thing. Yeah, so he was acquainted with using computers, and this really rang the bell with me, and we both looked at some of the papers that had appeared, particularly one that dealt with the use of electronics, vacuum tube electronics, to be sure, to build these analog computers of the time. And we found that there was one available from George Filbert, a little company in Boston. And we became one of his first customers. And he always appreciated what we did with those things. After a while, I began to buy just the components, the operational amplifiers that you plug in, and then you can build up whatever computer structure you want. And there was a basic structure that was pretty easy to put together using his plugins, or using the little boxes which really contained the plugins. And when I went to India in 54, I took along everything I would need, including tools like hole cutters and so on. Everything except relay racks. To India with me, and we built them up there with the help of the graduate students.
Before we get to India,
that really hit the spot with them.
Before we get to India, and I want to go into that because it's a fascinating story. Let's get back to Wisconsin for a second. How long did it take you to figure out? How did you figure out what was in that computer? How long did it take you to build one when you first started building them?
Well, not too long. Systems are described by...
What? Oh, close the door?
Yeah,
fine.
Systems are described, in general, by differential equations.
Mm-hmm.
Ordinary differential equations. And each differential equation requires a couple of these operational amplifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And one to integrate, one to add and subtract. And then once in a while, some that would do nonlinear functions, such as multiplying and function generation. So if you had any notion of how to write the differential equations for a system, it was very easy to put it into computer form by just using these basic elements, whether they were plugins or little boxes that Philbrick used to sell.
Did you, well, that all sounds easy. Maybe we should go back this afternoon, Paul, and try to construct a computer. Did you know Philbrick personally?
Yes, I got to know him quite
well.
Tell
me a little bit about how he started his company and how that...
I don't know. He was a very bright guy, very Eastern, you know, mm-hmm. I mean. And he was in Boston. And yes, I was out there visiting him in his home. And we became quite good friends. Sometimes he would come and visit Madison. Mm. One time we had him, and I got a stack of theses that high, where they'd used Filbert computers in the work that they did in these various theses, mostly masters, but some PhD. And so illustrated to him that there was a good academic use for his computers.
How many did he have a company? Did he work out of his garage? How did he
operate? Well, it wasn't much more than a garage. Yeah. He showed me the plant, and I don't suppose that the whole size of it was much more than this house.
About the size of the old computers.
Well, yeah. Well, of course, these were much smaller than the old mechanical computer.
Right.
And the digital computers really had to have quite a few components, mm-hmm. and then they could be used for any size of problem. But no matter how small, you had to have quite a few components in the digital computer. The analog, you just needed about the same number as the number of equations describing the system. And yeah, he was an interesting fellow. He tried to get me to take over as chief engineer in his company.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But I'd just come from the East, and I didn't want to move back. And I thought it was a little shaky, mm-hmm. you know, with the...
Did it turn out to be? How long did it last, the company? Do you know?
I suppose that it lasted for 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. And by that time, they should have been getting into the digital mm-hmm. area and using, of course. There were some people who took over with larger analog computers, particularly when the use of transistors became mm-hmm. standard. And so about sometime in the mid-60s, we got some of these large analog computers.
Did you get them from Philbrick?
And we did not get them from Philbrick. He did not go into those.
No, he didn't go into those.
No, I think he had health problems.
So it was a matter of health and then not going with the way things were going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, getting back to Madison in the early 1950s, there was a place called the Numerical Analysis Lab on campus. Let's talk about the status of computers on campus outside of the Philbrick and the work that you were doing. Did you work with the Numerical Analysis Lab at all?
Yeah, quite a bit. In particular, I worked as a member of a committee that met from time to time about the Numerical Analysis Lab and the equipment. And these were large and expensive computers mm-hmm. that they were buying quite early on. Mm-hmm. And so I worked as a member of this committee, and I was a little distressed by some of the people who were selling exceedingly large and expensive computers that weren't quite up to snuff as far as...
You were selling them to the Numerical Analysis Lab?
Yeah. Oh. So Jim Skiles might remember more about that than I do, because after a while he came onto that.
Yeah. The very beginnings of the Numerical Analysis Lab are kind of foggy. Do you know anything... Were you around when it started up, or did you join the committee when it was already going? Do you recall?
I was there pretty early. Earlier than Jim.
Was Preston Hammer, or...
Oh, yeah.
He was the charge. What kind of a guy was he?
Oh, he's a great guy. Yeah. And, yeah. Well, full of ideas and so on. I think that part of their weakness was they weren't used to being engaged in the purchase of electronic equipment. Mm-hmm. And there was someone trying to sell them a bill of goods, and we had a lot of trouble about that.
And that was located in Bascom Hall, was it not? Do you recall? Seems to me that's what Irv Shane said, but I can't really remember.
Could be. It wasn't in engineering, that's all I can tell you right now. Yeah.
In 1952, the book mentioned something called the Whisk Philbrick. What was that?
Well, there was a student,
W-I-S-C,
graduate student, over in physics. In fact, there were a couple of them. But this one was named Amdahl.
A-H...
A...
Dale.
A-H-M-D-A-H-L.
Something like that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Amdahl was interested in the digital computer. And some of these had appeared with quite a modern philosophy of for their design. And this student and another fellow, Charlie Davidson, also in physics, couldn't get the okay there to work on what they were interested in. So they came over to engineering, and Peterson greatly encouraged them to do their graduate work and, in fact, to get their degrees, their PhD degrees. And we were still back in the vacuum tube era. The machine, however, was, you know, about as big as a couple of desks piled up, I guess. And they had some novel ideas in that machine, which represented some improvement, hopefully, in the speed with which it would run. So they got other people to help them. So they had a basic gang of five or six people. But Amdahl was the real brains, and Charlie worked right along, mind you. But Amdahl, after graduation, founded his own company. They began to produce the large computers of the time at Amdahl, the name of his firm as well as his name.
Here in Madison, did he do that?
No, I don't know where it was located. But he finally was located out in the Silicon Valley area, I think. And he was quite successful with these Amdahls. Amdahl computers.
And Davidson, didn't he stay here?
Yes, he did.
Or did he go away anywhere and come back, or did he just stay here?
He stayed here and stayed in our department. But some of his teaching was done in computer science.
Now, you said that physics didn't permit them to go in that direction. Why didn't they?
Well, they didn't have anyone working in that area interested in it to guide these people. Not that Amdahl needed much guidance, just stand out of his way.
One thing that Irv Shane said when he was talking about the numerical analysis lab as a young chemist here on campus, He said that he was the only chemist besides Joe Hirschfelder who was really using computers and who really kind of understood them and got into them at that point in time. How were computers viewed in the early 1950s on within your department and your college, and if you can even extrapolate to the campus? Did people understand the significance of what was happening?
Well, I think that quite a few of them grasped that, and but sometimes they would give lip service, but they'd never actually come and use a computer. Mm-hmm. I found this particularly when I came to run the, well, first it was an analog and then a hybrid computer in our department. There were, as I was soliciting the funds, most of which came from National Science Foundation. People signed up, oh, they were going to use it for this and that, but they didn't. I don't know why. It was the new, younger people who came mm-hmm. along,
mm-hmm.
who later made good use of them. And do you want me to tell you something about my experience in India, which came along pretty early?
I want ask one more question, then I was going to take us to India. You said the National Science Foundation supported your research, supported
yes.
the computer. Were they then pretty generally supportive of this new movement?
Yes.
Was there mm-hmm. anyone in particular that you can remember from the foundation, or was it?
No, I can't remember.
Okay.
But there probably was.
Yeah. Okay, that would be an interesting thing as to why they would get into it so early when there were others who were just talking the talk but not walking the walk, so to speak.
Yes, yes, that was very helpful, and it was around, well, we were getting on. It was in the mid-60s,
wow.
early and mid-60s, that they came up with, it was about a quarter of a million, I think. Get this whole thing set up.
Let's go to India. How did you find out? How did you get sent there? And tell me a little bit about who went with you and what was your year like and what did you do?
Well, it was an American government thing. It was called, had various initials. AID was one. And so they were set up, and in much the same way as the Marshall Plan
mm-hmm.
thing in Europe. There was money over there, and rather than have them pay it to us, the money was used to support people who were sent over, jointly selected,
mm-hmm.
And sent over to work in five or six of the main institutions, educational institutions. Peterson went over just to look at the whole situation, and I was interested and thought from the beginning I'd bring them the word on computing.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to take me for a while. The thought was, you know, that I didn't have a PhD.
No.
They really would like you to have had a Nobel Prize, or maybe two of them.
Now, are you talking about the AID people here?
No, the Indians.
The Indians.
They
had
some choice in this, too.
Okay.
But after a while, they decided maybe it was all right. Peterson could be very insistent about things, but he thought he was damn well right. So I went over, and I was the only one that took any equipment. Of course, computer equipment for the small thing I had in mind would all go into a big box, size of a trunk or something.
Now, who did you go with?
What other people?
What other people were with you on that trip, you remember? Your wife came along?
My wife and three boys.
Oh, they all came, and they were there for a year.
That's right. It was a great experience for them. And there are other people like Villamont,
uh-huh.
although he didn't go to the same institution. And these people, some of them were from other institutions in the U.S., but it was an engineering group. And I guess they all worked on equipment, but I took this stuff with me, and I took every damn thing, including hole saws and things that are very special to building up electronic equipment. And lucky I did, because they didn't have much there. In fact, the machine shop...
You were talking about the machine shop at the...
Yeah. So the machine shop was not in operation because they were, had changed over from DC machines driving the drill presses and so on to AC. But in typical Indian fashion, they had not gotten the AC lines run into the shop. So the, all the machines were sitting there ready to go. And after a while, I began to realize that while I was there during my year, I could not really expect them to get those leads run over. You have to learn these things about India. So I raised hell until they just ran temporary lines across the, through the hall and so on, got it over, got the damn things going so we could drill the holes that we needed and build up this equipment.
Did you work mainly with students or professors over there, or both?
I worked with some graduate students, very good ones. And so we got it together. And they, and the Indians, people thought, you know, this is, why do you take such advanced stuff to India? They need to find how to get away from starvation. They don't need computers, for God's sake. But they just loved it. They really, they're very good mathematicians. Some really phenomenal ones, but typically they were very good at mathematics, so that they took to computers in good style. And this little machine that I built up, which you could use to simulate the springing of a motor car or the operation of a control system in a hydroelectric generator or something of that sort. You know, you could do these small problems, illustrative problems, usually simplified. And so they liked this equipment, and my oldest son went to India with his wife. Oh, it was 20-odd years after we'd been there and built this up. And, oh, they had my picture on the wall. And you know, they'd run this machine for a long time. Longer than it deserved. And you wondered about what happened in India. Well, for one thing, I never did find this because I didn't get back to India. But there was a industrial firm set up that manufactured the Philbrick type of plug-ins and analog computers. But the big thing that's happened, and this mostly in the city where I was, Bangalore, famous as a fairly nice place to live and not too bad a climate, that became, they called it the Silicon Valley of India. And a great article on it in this crazy magazine called Wired, if you've ever seen it.
Oh, is that the internet magazine?
I don't know what it is.
It's just general? Oh, okay.
Yeah. But quite an article on Bangalore and how I would love to see it, because there was no sign of anything that had to do with computers. Now they've got organizations galore, but really it's not like Silicon Valley, not hardware, mm-hmm. but software they work on. Mm. So these mathematically minded Indians became just wonderful at software design, and they do software design for much of the Orient, and very successful at it.
Do you think maybe you're bringing that computer over there and starting that whole thing? Do you think that had anything to
do with
generating the interest?
I don't know. I make a big noise out of it.
You'd entertain the thought then.
The first computer in India. I really think it was. Nobody's ever argued with me on that. Of course, it was analog, and what was to come was digital.
Yeah, but that would make sense that they once you would start with where you were and then advance with the flow of the times. So mm-hmm. you never went back there. Did you keep contact with any of those people?
Yes, kept contact. And some fellow from Bangalore recently asked me for this bioengineering.
The person from India asked you about your book, your new book.
Yeah, so I sent that along. Mm-hmm. But I did keep in touch, and I knew that these students, graduate students that worked with me in this construction and the early operation, oh, they liked that. Mm. They went on to become rectors or chancellors mm-hmm. of engineering colleges. And so on. And what an improvement this must have been, because the people who were in charge in 54, 55, 7 years after India got its independence, these were political rascals mm-hmm. who were in charge, and they really were not too good at running universities. Or the telephone factory. I was dismayed, you know, to see that they had to bring in all their designs from England and to build telephones. Didn't use any of the students that we had trained in the telephone company. And then it was run by someone who had run a silk mill.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So I was a very young fellow then, or felt that, and I did not like to make a big noise about where their politics had mm-hmm. taken them. Mm-hmm. But I did build the machine, and this went over big.
As we historians, you like to say, the rest is history, the development after that. You came back to Madison then, and you continued to work in analog computers, but your interest eventually began to shift as the digital computer became a factor. How could you explain your movement into the digital computer field?
Well,
or discuss rather.
I became interested in it because I had something to do with Omdahl and Davidson, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and they were working on the WISC, and. Later on, some of my students actually used the WISC as a computer. Hmm. So it was more than just a project. It became an actual working computer. But seeing that the digital computer had certain advantages in being able to do things of a logical nature, mm-hmm. The thing that a lot of people were interested in, including me, was the hybrid computer, mm-hmm. which is a combination mm-hmm. of an analog and a digital. And that was hard to beat. Here was the digital, capable of logic, with memory, and all kinds of memory, and the analog, capable of solving differential equations at high speed. So the all-digital could not compete with the hybrid at that time. And the all-analog suffered from mm-hmm. not being able to do these logical things, nonlinear things, and memory storage things that were also essential in modeling studies.
Oh, so you were starting to get into modeling at this point, and
from the beginning, I was concerned with modeling. Yeah.
Well, can you give an example of a problem you'd present to the hybrid computer? What problems are more ideally suited for?
Mm-hmm. I suppose that. So many problems. What can I think of that was a good one? let me think about that. But one thing that we could simulate, which is coming along, was a computer-controlled system. For example, a system for control of a hydroelectric generator. Here you can describe the generator by differential equations, and those can be set up on the analog part of a hybrid computer. But you might have digital equipment or even a digital computer which would do the thinking sort of control, the control of a controller, if you wish, or the control of the generator itself, the hydroelectric generator. And so, some of my work at that time was at Alice Chalmers, consulting work, once a week, usually.
In Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, yeah. And so here we became interested in problems of this sort. And analog would represent the system with its differential equations, but the controller, which might be a digital computer, eventually was, and that's what we do nowadays, and we'd simulate that digital computer by a digital computer that was hooked into the analog. I suppose one of the best models ever set up was by a Japanese student, Fukui.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one of your students.
Yeah. And he set up a large system which involved simulation of the cardiovascular system and the respiratory system. And later on, this whole system was set up to be taken under anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
And here, the analog and digital were used together. Digital to do some of the more complex things, the analog to do those differential equations that had to be solved to run fast. And we can make this whole system run at least 10 times real time. And this way you can simulate something like a 4-hour operation in a reasonable amount of time to study it, go over and over and over, with the 4 hours cut down by a factor of 10.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe even more in some cases. You know, so getting into the biomedical engineering work and still using the hybrid computer, the very best models. And I don't think that you can improve on them today with all digital means. Mm-hmm. Were came out of laboratories like ours.
When we were talking to Jim Skiles about your work, he said one of the things that impressed him about your research is you were not afraid to challenge yourself and delve into, as he said, new fields and promising areas of research. You just mentioned the bioengineering. Now, how did you develop your interest in the circulatory system? How did you train yourself, and how did you get into that whole, I think, relatively new area in your career?
Because of being on that committee, I was acquainted with digital computers. Also, from the work of Omdahl. But mostly I had worked with analog before, about 1963, when I went to teach at Boulder for a year. And did a lot for my skiing, I must say. Be able to go on ski trips out of Boulder. In fact, the whole department would take off every Thursday afternoon. It was a...
Be for a three and a half day weekend?
No.
You jumped to Eldora, I bet, right?
Go to Eldora.
Yeah.
Yeah, on Thursday afternoons.
This is the, like a Wednesday afternoon golf and...
That's right. Sure. Oh, that was nice. So I went to Boulder, and they had in mind that I would be chairman, but I couldn't see the possibilities there. It was, pay scales weren't quite up to snuff. Mm-hmm. And it was not a democratic kind of an institution, and I couldn't figure out just who was running it, but it wasn't the ordinary professors, that's for sure. So I only stayed there for the year. Mm-hmm. When I came back and thinking of all the things that we'd gone into, including nuclear reactors to model at Alice Chalmers, I became interested in going into something new and different.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow got the notion that we could work on the systems in the human body. And coming back, I had a whole new bunch of students
mm-hmm.
came to work with me. And so they were quite willing. You see, they didn't have to make any money out of it. They just had to come up with a thesis. And so we began to model.
Did you study with doctors here? Did you buy medical books? How did you learn about all these technical parts?
Oh yeah,
of
we worked with people in physiology. Several very cooperative people, and we would, for example, go over and see how they did things in the catheterization lab.
Mm-hmm.
And we would see how they got along with their animal experiments, and we proposed animal experiments. But we would do things that they'd never think of, which came to us because of our engineering
mm-hmm.
experience.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you want to study distortion in a sound system, you will use two oscillators and feed these frequencies in. Perhaps one is at one kilocycle and another one is at five or some other frequency. And what comes out then will still be one kilocycle and five kilocycles, but if there's any sum and difference, you see, six or four, 5 plus 1, 5 minus 1 appearing, those products are caused by nonlinearities. And that's a very sensitive way to see if the system is nonlinear, which you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
In a sound system. Well, we did the same darn thing to look at the heart and the whole arterial system of a dog. And we put two pumps on in place of the heart, and we pumped away at this system, and we looked for the sum and difference frequencies, where we pumped at slightly different frequencies, steadily. And we got a pretty good handle on the nonlinearities.
Mm.
Yeah. And later on, did some other interesting things that had some relation, were studied with a computer, but had some relation to the microwave work I'd done at Bell Telephone Laboratories.
I remember, maybe you mentioned it to us, or maybe Jim Skiles did, didn't you work with someone from Holland on the bioengineering
model? Yeah. Early in my efforts to model the heart and cardiovascular system in particular, later on the breathing system as well, I was at a meeting in, I guess it was in Florida, in Gainesville. And here I met a young Dutchman named Beneken. And Beneken had done a PhD work on very advanced modeling
in Holland
of the human heart. And other people in Holland had done such modeling. They were way ahead of us, in other words. So I decided better get this guy's knowledge, and I invited him. He'd been spending a year at Jackson with a famous heart surgeon, but I persuaded him to come to Madison. He had his family with him, and to work with me in this simulation study. That was a big help.
Mm-hmm.
And Beneken and I have been good friends ever since. In fact, he was here just a year ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you eventually traveled to Holland to look at their setup, is that right?
Yes, he was running a laboratory, a bioengineering sort of laboratory, government laboratory in Utrecht, Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me to come over for a year. And I accepted. For once, I'd be going someplace where I'd learned something instead of giving, as in India. And Indonesia and so on. So I went very happily there. We had our youngest son, who was not born when we were in India. But by this time, around 1970, our youngest was the only one that was still with us. We took him along. He boldly went to a Dutch school where they spoke. Everything was in Dutch, but he picked it up, you know, in pretty short order. He's been quite a linguist ever since.
Oh, interesting. Did you find out once you were there, or did you know before you went, how they got so involved? And you said they were so far beyond us in the modeling of the human heart, how that came about?
I think that this group, of whom Beneken was one, and there were others, and they weren't all at the same institution, but there were one or two professors who pushed them into this kind of thing. And I don't know. I suppose I have something that somewhere, but it's probably in Dutch.
We're looking at the bookcase now. I should point out that Professor Rideout said earlier, before we had the microphone on, that he has some his papers and whatnot stored in some boxes in the basement, which he intends to get at, that more or less show the development of his work over time. And he hopes to get to that, so there's a good chance that that will be available to anyone listening to this tape at some point in time. Hold on a second. Kick it off.
We also found that you spent a lot of time researching random processes. Can you touch on that area of your work?
Well, back when I was a graduate student, The idea of using Laplace transform and other transform calculus methods was quite new, and we all grabbed onto it, you know. And so made use of it to some extent while I was at Bell Telephone Laboratories. When I came to Wisconsin, after a few years, as far as mathematical work was concerned, became aware that there were people working not with the Laplace Fourier transform so much, but with similar sorts of transform methods that could be used with random processes, with noise signals. And so, whereas with Laplace transform, you just work with transients. With Fourier transform, you just work with sine waves, quite limited. And but with the Laplace transform mathematical methods, you can deal with transients and of most any form that you can imagine to be found in nature. But to go on from that, instead of having gone from the simple sinusoid to the random signals, the noise signals are something else again. And methods had been devised by people like Davenport at MIT to deal with this. Books began to appear. And so, with a group of students, and I had a dandy bunch of students, quite mathematically inclined, we would get together and each would describe one chapter in Davenport's book, or things of that sort. So we used this method. They liked it.
You'd get together as a group and sort of like a brown bag lunch or informally and do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And having the students come up with the analysis of and description of one of the chapters dealing with these new methods, they liked that.
Now, you mentioned in the videotape that I watched that Professor Cameron did of you discussing your work. You read off a list of the students that you had. It's very obvious, and in our discussions, that students were sort of your life's blood, that they were very important to keep you moving and keep you going on your research and in your teaching.
Yeah.
How and that started out right away. You mentioned earlier.
That's right.
Yeah. How did you manage to get these students? Did they just drop out of the sky? How much did you work on it?
Well, there they were, and eager to get into new things, and it was no problem to find students.
So they just started appearing right from day one.
Yeah.
And just kept.
Where do they tend to come from, students? Are they from all over the country, or a lot more regionally?
They were from all over, really, and there were, of course, we began to get some from foreign countries, including India.
The Japanese?
I had a Japanese student. They're rare.
No, they are.
I had one, but he was great.
Just that one. That was great. Are there any others? You mentioned a few. You mentioned Davidson and Amdahl and the Japanese student. Are there any others that really stand out in your mind?
There was one local boy. He lived just the next street over. Don Dick. And he worked on setting up Benikin's heart model in computer form, in new computer form, and with the dog as a model. And did a very good job with that extremely complex model of Benikin's. Yes, these were students from all over, about an average crop, with some Chinese. I had some excellent some terrible Chinese students. What else?
Would you have considered your graduate students here on par with places like MIT and Michigan and Purdue, some of those more, you know, stronger engineering schools, or?
Yes, I think that certainly I wouldn't want to say that I or too many of us were on a par with the professors at MIT and
Caltech.
Yeah, but the students were as good as you'd find any place.
Yeah. How many did you oversee as for PhDs? Do you recall?
Oh, well, I had, you mean total over the years?
Over the years, yeah.
Yeah, 32 PhDs.
That's a handful.
They're all mentioned in there. List is given.
Oh, in the back of the history of the College of Engineering book. That's right. They did have a list of all the for the entire department.
At any one time. I would not have probably more than two or three PhD students, but I would have master's students coming along.
Did you generally have adequate funding for these students? Did most of them get funded through the department, or did how did that work?
There's two ways they get funded. One was as TAs, teaching assistants in the department. And we needed them, so some of them would go in that direction. Mm-hmm. But also I'd find funds from National Science Foundation and from NASA, for example. We had quite a, with one of the students that I should mention, Snyder, Maurice Snyder. He worked on the effect of changing gravity on human circulation, of interest, of course, in the space effort.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got him supported by NASA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
He got out a dandy thesis.
Now, I look at the pictures from the College of Engineering from when Dean Tanur, when Tanur was dean, and then I go over there today. Paul and I were just there 2 days ago for a meeting. And the cast of the of student body back in Tanur's days was essentially all white males. Mm-hmm. And you certainly get a different feeling walking around the engineering campus today, not only in terms of race, but in terms of gender. Mm-hmm. When did women first start entering the program in the college?
Well, I remember around the time that I was going to Holland, giving talks to try to incite females to come into engineering, telling them, you know, they've got mathematical minds that are as good as the men, and they're not dealing with great heavy equipment where they have to be physically strong and to work with something, as in building a bridge. Design it, that's one thing, but building it, you're bound to get into some heavy sorts of work that maybe women would naturally avoid. And to some extent, I suppose that's reasonable. But here in engineering, especially in these new fields, computer engineering, why? They should come, and they began to come. I think that we did. We were happy to have them. They were a little shy about it for a while.
What about now? You had a who is the woman professor, Paul?
Lois Greenfield.
Lois Greenfield. Was she the first woman to teach on the faculty? To your recollection?
Yeah, she was partly in administration and not in our department, so I knew Lois well, but I can't remember too much about her the technical side of her work.
Yeah, we should be talking to her sometime this year also.
Good.
Let's go to Kuwait. This is a sort of a difference. You're still working in the modeling field, but the very first time Paul and I met you, you talked for a few moments off mic about how you got involved in what is just a fascinating economic modeling program in Kuwait. Could you just give us the background on that and how that went?
A little hard to remember what came first, but I do remember getting interested in world modeling. And this was a name for, you know, giant models of the economic system. And some people were overly ambitious with those, mm-hmm. but it was interesting. Something else that we could model, mm-hmm. we could put on the computer. And I had some students interested in this. We then went, around the time of my early interest in world modeling of an economic kind, people largely, strangely enough, in ag economics were concerned with a cooperation set up by former students between the University of Wisconsin and organizations like the Arab Oil OPEC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. About what time was this, just approximately?
I think it must have been about early or mid-70s.
Okay. So the ag econ people are interested in things like OPEC?
Yeah. Yeah. And So someone asked me if I was interested.
So someone asked you if you would be interested in joining a Wisconsin seminar?
Yeah. And I was kind of busy being on the university committee at mm-hmm. that time.
Which we'll talk about later on, yes.
But I couldn't resist the idea because I'd gotten some interest in this modeling, and I decided that's why they wanted me, because of my concern with modeling. And so I said yes, but I insisted that they pay part of my salary if I was mm-hmm. going to really meet each week a time or two with this group. And this included Peter Dorner,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Dean of International Studies.
Yeah. And then the number one fellow from the Arab countries was El Shafi. And he was the United Nations chief planning advisor. So there was a United Nations sort of tie-in there. But then we had people like Al-Watari, who was assistant secretary general of OAPEC, the Organization of Arab Petroleum. I can't tell what all those letters are for at this moment. But at any rate, these fellows are listed here. Al-Watari is from Kuwait.
We're looking at the book called Resources and Development, Natural Resource Policies and Economic Development in an Interdependent World, which is edited by Peter Dorner and El Shafi.
Yeah. Now, initially, they had people from various Arab oil countries, and a group brought in. Some were students, and one was a student that I latched on to. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if he's listed here. Here they list certainly the more senior people. But he and I worked together very happily after the committee had pretty well done its work. This work took, we worked hard for about a year, and then we began to write this book, each one did different, slightly different area. And so it was interesting. These people were from various countries. We had quite a few from Libya, for example.
Interesting. Yeah.
And we all got along all right. And finally the time came to go and give papers in Kuwait at a meeting there. And so I guess Kuwait had the money to support this. And we had, well, Peter Dorner and Al Shafi, for example, had the final paper, which was given in Kuwait, and which appears in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And this was entitled Natural Resources and Development Policies. And I had the paper preceding that, Modeling Studies of Socioeconomic Resource Systems. And so I got into modeling and had these...
Did the modeling work in an economic sense? Were you able to do what you had set out to do?
Well, not for this Kuwait thing, but later. Later. With my graduate students, I did a PhD thesis on modeling the economic system of a country the size of Kuwait or Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't it work when you were working on the Kuwait thing? Was it just not quite there yet?
Well, we were mostly blowing wind, you know, and sitting in these conferences. And once in a while, I'd go up to the blackboard with something a little bit mathematical, and it was a little hard to push. But at any rate, after we began to get our ideas organized, this meeting in Kuwait was set up, and so I was very happy to join. I had some adventures getting there, losing my luggage.
Mm.
We insisted on taking along an economist who had spent some time with us, who was Jewish.
Oh.
So we insisted that he come, keep these guys honest. And he and I both lost our luggage getting there.
Yeah. Was there any?
But fortunately, I had my slides and change of underwear in my little briefcase. And I was able to survive.
Did he have any problems being Jewish in Kuwait?
No, none. He wasn't, you know, making a big thing of it or anything. But he was very good at going back to the airport and looking for lost luggage. Mm. So I said, look for mine.
That's kind of ironic. You're talking about Peter Dorner's article at the end about natural resources and economic development or whatever it is. And what were your feelings as you were watching the Kuwaiti Iraq debacle of a few years ago?
Well, you know, who could? I realized that the people in Kuwait were wealthy. Everyone there shared in the wealth, and it was a very nice, cozy sort of a thing. They didn't have a standing army. They couldn't protect themselves. And the attitude of the Iraqis was somewhat like Hitler and Nazi Germany's, you know. Let's just take over and run things.
Was there any talk about that kind of stuff informally when you were there?
No.
That was just not an issue.
No discussion, whatever.
Leaving Kuwait, we learned in our research that you worked with one of your sons on the modeling of, what was it, chemical drug interactions?
Ah, just so happens that's just right here. We're trying to get it into final form.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is my last, I emphasize that word, my last paper. And it's called Evaluation of Prospects for In Vivo Anti-Tumor Drug Assembly Using a Three-Compartment Model. So, once again, you know, you go into these new areas and bring computer work to them. And so what happened was that Daryl told me about this scheme that he had devised for an anti-cancer drug administration. A scheme is one in which you put two drugs into the body, both which are not harmful to good cells or bad. Mm-hmm. And these will enter the good cells and the cancer cells, and eventually, as they get together, they will combine, and they're designed to combine into a cancer-killing cytotoxin, in other words. So he has a patent on this sort of thing from when he was at Rockefeller University, and he's a bright young guy who never slowed down after we took him to Holland. And so he got on onto this idea at Rockefeller University, which is that university that doesn't have students.
Right. The university.
Occasionally a PhD student. And from there, he got a job at Scripps in their molecular biology laboratory, which is
a very nice place to work. That's one of the most beautiful settings.
Yes, he had this nice office, and through the window he could look out over the Torrey Pines.
Torrey Pines.
Golf course to the to the sea, and so it was a nice place. And rubbing elbows with Nobel Prize winners and so on. It was a great environment. He finally left it and got into regular industry because he couldn't stand the need 4 times a year to take off immense periods of time to write requests for money. Well, these applications really, that's tough. And then 70% of the money would go to Scripps, and with the remainder he'd have to get enough of these grants to pay his own salary, with the 30% remaining, and his assistants, and so on.
And as money gets tighter, I suspect that might...
As money got tighter, this got to be really tough.
Where did he go?
Still in San Diego, and... he's with a company called Galderm, which is really a French company. And but they're into pharmaceutical design, and that's his dish. He has to go to Nice and visit the Riviera about twice a year, which is tough.
But that's too bad.
Somebody has to do it. He was just there. He was just there. And I have a grandson who's got a year's job singing a lead in Phantom of the Opera in German, in Germany. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he learned the language. But this grandson is up in Hamburg. So last week he got together with my youngest son.
Oh, his, how wonderful.
His uncle, who's not too much older than him.
Did any of your kids go to UW?
Yes. The oldest three boys all graduated from UW. Darryl was a very good student in high school. And I foolishly said, you know, you're doing so well. Now, if you want to go to some great school, Harvard, you name it, why, I'll support it. He applied anxiously to all the schools out there, you know, Harvard and Princeton, and they all accepted him. He went to Princeton, and that really cost me. I didn't realize what it would cost. There's been inflation since, but I can only say it cost me like a new Cadillac every year.
Oh, jeez.
But he did well.
We've talked about your research, just a brief, obvious snapshot of your research over the years, but let's talk about the research for a moment, about the research climate at the UW during your years here. Let's talk about the College of Engineering and the department that you were in, electrical engineering. And before we do that, the name changed in 1972 when you were chair to electrical engineering to electrical engineering and computer science. Was that it?
No. Electrical and computer engineering.
And computer engineering.
Yeah, we didn't put in that word science. Some schools did.
How involved, how responsible were you for that change?
I did it.
You did it?
I did it, yeah. I could see, and I managed to persuade the department. It wasn't too easy, but we were about 40% computer people by this time, which is around the 1980, 78, somewhere.
I think it was in 72 that you did it.
Was that early?
Maybe. I might be wrong.
That's right. That's right.
We can check on that.
That is right. 10 years off. At any rate, I pushed through this idea. It wasn't easy. It's not easy to change the name.
Yeah. Did you get the resistance from within the department, or?
Some, yeah. They couldn't see it, but after a while, you know, I got an influential guy, so it was Jed Dyke, to go and talk to some of these schools that had changed their name, and to look at this data on our department. The big thing was, you see, the only department with computer in its name was computer sciences, which are in LNS.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of engineering, so we thought roughly we should do hardware, they should do software. That's not a clean-cut thing. They do hardware, all right, and we do software. But we decided to make this go into this new name. We got objections that I wouldn't have believed from the people interviewing for Hewlett-Packard.
Really?
I couldn't believe it, because they're so deeply into computers themselves.
Yeah.
But the interviewers objected. They said,
Who's doing the interviewing now? The people from...
These are engineers. I'm an interview for... to find students that they want to hire.
And they were objecting to the change?
That's right. It made me mad.
That's baffling. I can't imagine why they do that.
But I got the name change, finally. And the real trouble was up in the hill.
Uh-huh.
I didn't care for all this too much.
What happened?
Persistence overcame them.
Anybody in particular who was objecting to it?
No, I can't really say that.
That's interesting. So you got it.
Yes. Yes.
Getting back to my original question, that was just a little tangent.
And I am really proud of the fact that we did it, you know, with setting up really good relationships with computer science department.
So the objections weren't from the people who one would suspect might have objected, namely the computer science people, but it was from other sources that...
And they We got joint professorships and joint courses and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've had a real good working relationship
with
that department.
Very important. Yeah.
I think so.
The original question, research environment on campus. And within the College of Engineering, did you get a lot of support for your research? Was there any problem with that over the years? Or did some deans, I know Wendt wasn't much of a researcher himself. Was there a difference in the support you got from the different deans or from the different, during the different periods of time that you were working on this?
No, I think it was all pretty good. But in general, we had to find grant money to help us to support students. Some of them were supported by being teaching assistantships, as I've mentioned. But if you want to get a student as an RA, a research assistant, well, you had to come up with the money. And we could get grants, big and small, from National Science Foundation, from NASA, and also from certain industrial concerns.
Now, you just gave us a horror story, which I've heard other people talk about with places like Scripps, where it's so you spent so much of your time trying to get money that it just absolutely destroys you after a while or forces you to consider changes, as what happened with your son. Over the course of your years at UW, was it pretty steady in terms of, was it difficult to get money? Did that change over time? Did it become more difficult, less difficult, anything like that?
As I went along, I found it getting easier to get the money. More money was there. It wasn't that I became more skillful at getting money, but it did seem that money was there. And then we had some problems, you know. You'd be interviewed by some group set up by National Science Foundation, or NIH in the case of the bioengineering. And sometimes these people could be a little difficult. And sometimes rather unfair, I thought.
Yeah, I've heard that they sometimes have different agendas than... Did any of that ever really affect your research?
Not just too much, no. Not too much.
Now, when Paul and I were given a tour of the some of the different labs in engineering about, a month ago or something like that, we saw evidence in Don Novotny's shop, for example, strong evidence of the importance of industry and the relation that's interchangeable, working back and forth, and support from different industries. How much did you work with research with industry in terms of the actual financing of your projects? How did that work during your years?
Not too much, but Don Novotny has been a wonderful example of someone who worked with industry, got industry support, and set up this whole WEMPEC operation. Really. A wonderful thing. I never did anything that good.
We're going to have to talk to him later on
absolutely.
How we went about that. It's very interesting.
One thing you mentioned in the video we viewed, you felt a lot of the graduate training for electrical engineering students was, quote, a bit too theoretical and not enough maybe industry supported or industry-related research.
Interaction.
Yes, that could happen. People, I remember meeting a young professor in Indonesia, and he had worked with someone, it might have been Philadelphia, somewhere on the East Coast, and he'd worked on a mathematical approach to something that you use in power work, Krohn, K-R-O-N, Krohn's method of tearing, as in tearing apart, of tearing matrices and dealing with matrices. Well, it's highly theoretical, pretty mathematical. And here was this young professor, and he just couldn't wait to get some graduate students in this new college we were helping them to set up, and to get students working on Krohn's method. And instead of, you know, the more down-to-earth things that would be useful in a new, in a country where technology is new. So sometimes I felt this happened with others, that we were too mathematical. And nothing wrong with mathematics. I've always been able to use anything that I ever had come across. Some way I've used it. But to get altogether mathematical troubled me a bit.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that where Novotny and his approach is really he's really refreshing?
Down to earth, yes.
Now, you mentioned a little earlier today that you did some work with Alice Chalmers in Milwaukee. What did you work with other industries?
Yes. Yeah.
What were some of them? Just
I worked with Alice Chalmers, and I worked with another large similar company whose name I cannot come up with at this moment. Also
in
Milwaukee, and I remember.
Not Cutler Hammer, was it?
Yes, it was Cutler Hammer. They changed their name or something to Eden? I can't remember. No matter. Yes, I worked with Cutler Hammer. And by that time, you know, well, it's true of Alice Chalmers, too. They had large analog machines. Mm-hmm. And I would help them with their machine simulation.
Yeah, they did some interesting stuff.
Yeah, but in that period. I tried always to go into the lab and look at the equipment and see it for real.
Like with the, just let's use Alice Chalmers as an example. Were their labs pretty well equipped?
Not bad. Not too bad.
Interesting.
A fellow I worked with at Alice Chalmers came to Madison. After Alice Chalmers sort of cut down on their research. Alice Chalmers was a company that had quite a bit of trouble.
Mm. They were very powerful for quite a while, very
yeah,
strong
that's
company.
True.
Well, let's turn just a bit toward one or two other things in terms of your career before we get to your service, the service aspect of your career. We've talked about your students somewhat. Of course, we could probably go on about that for many, many hours, but you gave us a sampling of some of the students and how important they were to you and your work. In terms of your teaching, you developed numerous courses over the years at the university.
Yes. Yeah.
Many of them are listed in this fine book, again, The Centennial History of the College of Engineering, so we don't have to really...
Well, of course, you know, I was the chief...
and you were the chief honcho on this book as well, I might add,
yeah.
So... but I just want to talk about some of the very basic courses that you started, and I'd also like you to say a little bit about the book that's sitting right there on the on your desk called Active Networks. Well, maybe we can start out with that, because that was started fairly early after your arrival to UW, was it not?
That's right.
Yeah. How did that idea for writing, and it's a textbook published by Prentice Hall, how did that idea come about to write that book?
Well, I could see the need, and I had the notion, in fact, before I even got to the
university here, that I would write a textbook because of the astounding, I can only say astounding, experience I had in going even from Caltech, much more advanced school than the University of Alberta in Edmonton, and yet they just didn't know what was going on in electronics communication and later on computers. And they had no idea of the measurements. But here at Bell Labs, why, they not only doing these measurements, but they built their own equipment. Mm-hmm. If you wanted an oscilloscope, you built your oscilloscope, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was fascinated by what went on there, and I became fascinated with the idea of bringing these new things to students. So I wrote this book. And
so this was a book written for electrical engineering students who are taking their sort of introductory courses, or is it for...
That's right. And I remember particularly a fan letter, you might say, from a student at Oxford University. Mm-hmm. And at Oxford, they have a different way of teaching, you know. Mm-hmm. Don will have some students, and he will say, read this book. So he'll have them read, you know, say that you read for history or something at Oxford or Cambridge. You kind of read and then meet with your professor once a week or something. It's a different way of doing things. Mm-hmm. But this fellow, and it puts them on their own to read and learn on their own. And having their major professor just kind of polish this off. Well, so I wrote this book, and this fellow wrote to me and said he liked it because it was great for self-study. And I was glad to hear that from a guy at Oxford.
The book came out in 52, is that right?
I think it says 54
here. 54, yes, I'm sorry. I got
yeah, but I'd been using it in note form for a few years.
And it went through several printings?
11.
Do you have any idea how many copies were sold?
No, I don't. But it was pretty popular. It must have been adopted here and there. Otherwise, it wouldn't sell so many.
Right.
11 printings. How many years was it in use? Is 11 printings, does that constitute 4 years or 5 years or 10
years? Well, this is one thing that happens, you see. Transistors came along.
Ah.
And the invention is formally given as 48, I think, but really it was around earlier. And by the time this book was nicely into use, why, transistors made it old-fashioned. Mm.
Did you ever update it, or would that have been just too much to include transistors in that technology?
No, I was into other things, computers and so on, and it was pretty hard to come up with a successor to this. It would have to be all new.
So, on other things, yeah. Now, some of the courses you taught, the first course, you said that early on you got stuck with a bunch of clinker courses that really weren't very challenging. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if you said this off mic or on mic, but you said that you considered leaving UW early on because the courses were not, were just...
True, I was not allowed to teach the material that I was an expert in.
Now, when did that change and why?
Well, we got so damn many students that we had more courses.
Uh-huh.
And I got to teach the electrical engineers and develop this textbook because I was needed to handle the sheer numbers. And then I got graduate students.
And that really changed things.
Oh, that changed things.
Now, one of the courses that's mentioned in the book, I think, is Servo Mechanism in 1948, and that's your first course in automatic control.
Yeah.
It was that when you were just starting to get into your own
Your
own stuff,
yeah,
at that point. Another one was courses, you taught some courses in circuit theory early on as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were these courses popular? Were they what the students were actively?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I didn't have any unpopular courses.
And did these courses, I guess what I'm saying is, so many times in different fields, history is an example, you teach a course in medieval history, and you teach that the first day you come here, and you can pretty much teach it the same way when the day you leave 40 years later. But it seems like, obviously, this is an entirely different thing we're talking about
things, here. Things completely turn over every 7 to 10 years, you know.
So you would have to turn your courses over.
And I guess that also brings in the need for a lot of self-education for faculty members.
That's true, and that's a problem, you know, to learn these new things. And the way is to read journals and to do research.
How does one keep from calcifying? Obviously, you didn't have any problem because you were moving into all these new areas all the time, but... you mentioned that when you came here, some of the older teachers hadn't really moved with the times and were a little bit behind.
No, they had no way to really know what was going on. And too bad, but they were just kind of locked into the system here.
You talked...
Had some excellent people, you know, great teachers. Price, you know, never hear of him, but he could really lay down a beautiful course. And Benedict, who went on to write many books, very good man, some excellent people, but, you know, they were isolated from the new things going on, new ways of doing things, waveguides, you know. Really didn't know much about waveguides.
What about scientific journals back in the mid to late 40s? Were they something, were there many of those around and were there things?
Yeah, IEEE had good journals, and then others began to appear. Great number.
Mm-hmm.
Great number.
Mm-hmm. After a brief little discussion here, we decided that we will finish the interview with one additional session because we did not want to rush through the section on service, Professor Rideout's service and his retirement. So that's all for today, October 10th, 1997. How do you turn this thing off?